Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions and the law. My name is Matthew Kurbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Andrew Legrand. Andrew is the founding attorney of Spira Law Group and a longtime user of the subscription model as business counsel. In fact, he offered his first subscription 10 years ago in 2013. All of my guests are great, but in this episode in particular, almost every answer to every question is a knowledge bomb for subscription lawyers, which is why I'm recommending that you queue up this episode twice in your podcast feed, since there's so much value here that you're going to get more out of it with subsequent listens. Thanks as always to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, links to both in the show notes, more on them later. Remember to use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. It lets them know you found out about them from the podcast, you get 10% off, and it really supports the show. For subscriptionseminar.com, I'm taking firms off the waitlist one at a time in the order they signed up, so sign up now to get your spot in line. I'm an active participant in that process and a full-time practicing attorney, so I could only help so many firms at a time. Thank you for your patience. Another way to support this show is to share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast Law Subscribed today. You've been doing this for a long time, but just in case my listeners haven't come across you before, please give them a quick introduction.
Sure. So my name's Andrew Legrand. I own the law firm, the Spira Law Group in New Orleans, Louisiana. We are outside general counsel for growing businesses, and we charge for value, not for time.
Longtime listeners will appreciate what that means, but just in case this is somebody's first episode, what do you mean charge for value?
So we're big believers in the sense that value is really determined by the purchaser of whatever it might be. That might be in any context. It doesn't just have to be for legal services. But whenever there's a buying transaction, the purchaser determines what the value of the thing is. So sometimes, you know, we might see something that one person's willing to pay $500 for a steak, someone else is only willing to pay $5. It's just the difference in perceived value there. Whereas a lot of lawyers charge for their time and, you know, they say, hey, it's $500 an hour, which really has no indication on value and leads to a lot of perverse consequences and weird ideas. Sometimes that means that, you know, an attorney that's been practicing for a long time can give somebody advice in 15 minutes that's worth, that has a value that's significantly more than $500 or whatever a quarter of $500 is, $125. Or they wind up in a situation where the attorney does, you know, hours and hours and hours and hours of value. It says, oh yeah, by the way, I don't have an answer for you. And where that doesn't have a lot of value to the client, but the client winds up paying $500 an hour times tons of hours. So, you know, our whole thing is, hey, how do we actually make the cost of our services reflect the value, not just the time?
So where was it that you first came to this idea? Was it something that was taught to you? Did you read it somewhere? Or is this like a synthesis of different things and you're like, aha, I'm going to do it this way?
I think it just, I'm not sure where. Our first subscription we offered, the first one we sold was 2013 to a small limo company. I think it started out with, you know, one of the reasons I decided to, I graduated law school in 2011 and wanted to practice in a small firm by myself, realized that a lot of firms at the time were not using technology very well, were pretty outdated, were still paper heavy, still went to the office downtown and, you know, took the time to park, get down there, and everyone goes up to this building. Just didn't like that whole process, thought it was incredibly inefficient and ineffective, generally saw the fact that consumers weren't super happy with the legal model. And also it was 2011 and law firms weren't hiring. So it was also a time when it wasn't super easy to get a job. So all those things kind of led me to start at the time Andrew Legrand Law, which we eventually rebranded, but started the firm and trying to decide, hey, what practice area do I want to go into? What do I want to do? Realized that, yeah, I liked business just because I like business. I like the idea of it helps people grow. I also like the idea that clients were, they needed our services on a regular basis. And I think that started to get me thinking about subscriptions and started looking at the value of a business that offers subscriptions. And it just kind of all started to kind of make sense. It also started to make sense where I had so many business clients that came to me with these problems that I'm looking at. I'm like, this is just a really, really stupid problem you're in. And it's going to cost me a ton of time. It's going to cost you a ton of money for me to solve. But you could have avoided this problem entirely by just talking to somebody on the front end. Mm-hmm. And so I saw this problem in the marketplace where a lot of business owners do something stupid that they just don't get legal advice for it. And realizing that the legal marketplace was missing the opportunity to help these people. So many people see lawyers as problem solvers, not as problem preventers. And in the world of business law, it's definitely a problem preventer practice area.
I really want to unpack even more about like this origin process, but I cannot say no to that section of the conversation, because not that long ago from the date of recording this interview, I had Conrad Somm on a LinkedIn Live, and we were talking about how do you even market and sell problem avoidance or problem prevention, as you put it. And that is because that is when you're subscribing to legal advice or services or whatever the model is. Yeah, you're going to charge less because you're not fixing a burst legal pipe, but it's problem avoidance. And people don't like to buy avoidance. They like to buy solving, like psychologically. So like you've been doing this for a long time. Like what has been your experience with trying to solve or trying to sell problem prevention? Would have been some of the lessons that you've learned over the years?
Well, exactly that, right? You know, there's a lesson right there in that not everybody wants to buy problem prevention, right? So automatically right away, that is something that when a client contacts us or a potential client contacts us, is we start trying to identify, are they the buyer that wants that? And we've realized, you know, that idea of we only sell to, we do help people out of problems, but we primarily, our ideal client is somebody who values problem prevention. And what is that going to, right? So if you think about that, the person that is, you know, starting a food pop-up and they've got $250 to buy some equipment probably doesn't care about problem prevention, mm-hmm. right? The multi-million dollar business owner who's been working on their business for 20 years and has family and kids, and has business partners and is 45 to 55 years old and is thinking about retirement, they're probably more likely to buy problem prevention. So that really does, that is a thing that we look at and we kind of appreciate. And so, you know, I think early on it was, well, why don't people want this? And the more we've gotten into it, the more we realize that just goes into the client profile. Is this somebody who is willing to buy problem prevention? And that's who our ideal clients are.
Yeah. So narrowly defined like client avatar, which allows you to better identify ways to market to them. But even that, even like hearing you describe that so well, still makes me think like some of the ways that people find lawyers is they have intention because they have a problem. So they go to a search engine in the future, in the near future, maybe, you know, generative AI, and they'll prompt it mm-hmm. for a solution. And so I like pay-per-click, like things like that, like, you know, and I'm not a legal marketing expert, but I still feel like even when you have such a well-defined client avatar, those traditional, if you could call it that, like ways to for them to find you still don't work. I would think, correct me if I'm wrong, but if they don't work and my intuition is right, how do you target those people? How do you help with them discovering your law firm?
We're always experimenting with that. You know, so far it's still a lot of me being out there in the world and networking and getting that word out there and finding those business owners, you know, using that client persona, trying to figure out where they might be, where they're going to be. We are starting to see an uptick in people looking for, you know, one of the advantages we have is I think people are starting against the hourly rate is no consumer really likes the hourly rate. You know, maybe there's an argument that some big insurance companies like it and prefer it. Sure, fine. But I don't think there's anyone out there that is a champion of the hourly rate, or at least that's a pretty small number of people. So I think people are looking for an alternative. So I think there is an advantage to, as people start to say, oh, what is legal subscription? We are starting to see searches for that term go up. And so we can start to leverage that. And just a lot of social media and getting out there and spreading the word starts to get people into this idea of it. The other times a lot of people contact us with a specific problem and they say, I've got this specific problem. And they're like, well, what are your rates? How much do you charge per the hour? And you start to explain the subscription and they say, oh, that's interesting. So, you know, we are still seeing a lot of people are coming to us with a specific problem and then it turns into a long-term engagement with them.
Yeah. And so that begs another question of you're representing, you know, or your client, what'd you call it? Not avatar. You called it something else. Client profile or
I can't persona.
Yeah. Persona. Yes. Client persona. So your client persona, who's been in business for 20 years, multi-million dollars in revenue, they are perhaps they have perhaps previously hired a lawyer at a billable hour rate. So like they've experienced hiring lawyers before at the billable hour rate versus people who have never, or business owners who have never actually paid an hourly rate for an attorney before. What has been your experience with who's actually hiring you? Is it institutional clients or people who are new to legal services, like the latent legal market?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, our ideal clients typically are people who have hired a lawyer in the past. They've, you know, experienced that problem. They're sophisticated business owners. They realize that they have been in the legal seat, the owners have been in the legal seat themselves just by default, and they're trying to get out of the legal seat. And, you know, when they kind of approach that marketplace with that problem, a lot of times it's, you know, they look at the hourly rate, and the hourly rate is many multiples beyond the hourly rate of any of their employees. And so I think that's hard to grasp. You know, when you look at even a well-earning employee is not going to be earning $500 an hour, right? So you see this attorney company, you're like, well, what is it? I think there's a disconnect there, is that business owners kind of start to equate that. And so when we say, hey, we can offer a service that you can budget for each month, you have access to us, you can start to ask us questions, and we're also starting to look for problems. I think they start to see value in that. And that's, you know, that it is tough to find, like, where are those people and how do you get them? But it definitely is something that if they've worked with an attorney in the past, when I've talked to my clients about that, a lot of them do not have really great experiences. And especially when you talk to them about a problem, like a litigation matter, and you say, this could have easily been prevented. And they're like, well, I spent tens of thousands of dollars to resolve this. And it's like, well, yeah, but you weren't getting proactive advice on the front end. And we could have avoided this fairly easily.
Yeah. And to be clear, like, I don't think lawyers are being unethical, like litigation attorneys, when they are like, well, let's litigate this thing. Like, I don't think they're consciously trying to think like, oh, this is going to cost my client a lot of money. It's just the way that their business model works is they make money the longer they spend on a matter. So they are incentivized to litigate as opposed to problem avoid, because they're not thinking about lifetime value with their clients. They're thinking about, I'm going to get a chance, one chance to represent this client. I got to milk it for all it's worth. Right? Sound familiar in your experience?
I mean, you say that not unethical. That sounds like you're putting the interest of yourself ahead of the client. So, you know, I'm of the opinion in getting there that there is an argument, in my opinion, that the hourly rate is unethical because it puts the attorney in a financial conflict of interest with their client. And you know, that's essentially what ethics is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, while I don't think the ABA would necessarily back that up, and I'm not, you know, going to make that opinion, I'm not going to spend my time, effort, and energy trying to change that. You know, I'll hold that opinion, and I'll share that I think the hourly rate can be considered unethical for that reason, because it creates a conflict.
I will say, like, in my CLEs, when I talk about the ethics part of subscriptions and recurring billing, I actually do say something like that, where I think it is unethical. But I mean, what I meant to say, if it wasn't clear, is that I think lawyers are not, like, consciously deciding to do this because and they know it knowingly that it's unethical. I think it's more of like a subconscious, mm-hmm. like, because this is their business model. Even though I do ultimately think it's unethical, I don't think that they are being unethical intentionally anyway. But I'm 100% with you, Andrew, on that. But and it is really interesting to learn that classic marketing that has been used for forever for lawyers, networking, business development, going out there, meeting people, like these are still tried and true ways for problem avoidance attorneys like ourselves to go out there and get clients. And I've also found that institutional clients who were paying attorneys by the hour are always an easier sell on the subscription model than latent legal market clients who, like, have never hired an attorney before. Although, frankly, I think both of them like it equally, in my experience. And I've only been doing this for about 17 months at the time of recording. Congratulations on your 10-year anniversary, because it's 2023, and if your first subscription was in 2013, right? 10 years. I mean, you're up there with, you know, Kim Bennett and John Tobin, you know, with offering it for so long. And with that, you know, comes a lot of lessons. Like, if you now, I realize the technology is not where it was 10 years ago, but like separating out that part of it, like, what were some things that you know now that maybe you wish you would have known 10 years ago when you got started with this model, whether that's the model itself, how you charge, how to keep clients subscribed if that's your goal, like really open-ended, you know, what would you tell yourself from 10 years ago that you now know today?
Probably easier said than done, I guess, is my, you know, there's a lot there. You know, we're talking about, you know, 10 years ago when I sold it, I didn't have any written documentation, no written PSPs in a process. It was just me, and it was kind of a way of getting a client to pay me some amount every month. You know, now it's, we're a team, we're two attorneys, paralegal, an assistant, a bunch of outside contractors. And so, you know, we're a lot bigger and we need written processes, written procedures. I'm about to go on a three week vacation where I'll be completely disconnected. So, you know, the firm will need to continue to run and then continue to operate. But I think, you know, one of the biggest things is that it is a long revenue tail. You know, I've got some clients that have been with us for 3, 4, 5 years. And, you know, they've paid us revenue consistently every month, but that's not quite the same as a divorce where there's a large upfront payment, or a, you know, a traditional law practice where there's kind of that sum of money kind of comes at one time. It's been, you know, we have to deliver services every month for 5 years with that person. And so it's, you know, when you look at client lifetime value, we're starting to, you know, that's always climbing up for us. But the idea there too is that, like, that client lifetime value, just because that when that client calls and they want services, might take a long time to earn that much money from the client. And so I think that adds a lot of stress to a business in terms of you have to have the capital to have the systems in place to service client one, the same as you do service client 10. So it is an interesting model in terms of the capital outlay required. It's not quite as easy as the hourly rate to say, okay, well, I'm just going to open up shop. And, you know, it's my effort is almost paid for directly. There's a lot of things we do for clients where we put a lot of effort in and it takes several months for us to kind of get repaid back on that. And so understanding that model is kind of, to your point about me being one of the early attorneys to do this, is there's not a lot of, you know, guidance or other information on that kind of topic.
I mean, you and I have both tried to solve it. I mean, I've tried to solve that, you know, knowledge gap problem with this podcast. And you, if you Google your name, or depending on when you're listening to it, prompt ChatGPT or its equivalent in the future, you know, you've been talking about automating your practice at least since 2015. And so, you know, tell us a little bit about that. I mean, you know, you talked about Zapier, you've talked about other forms of automation. Like, I'm curious to know what technology are you using now to automate? And why is that so important as part of having a subscription practice?
Well, you know, that's kind of where the value starts to pay off, right? When I go back to the idea of value versus time, right? One of the switches that happens is when clients pay for value, not for time, I can now leverage myself with automation to drive value that doesn't take any time. So, and that's what automation is, right? That's what computers do. And so it's a few different things. It's that, it's how do we deliver more value? It's, you mentioned earlier kind of the ethics of it. You know, we're in a subscription and we want to remind clients about their upcoming charges, right? And so at first when I was doing it was, you know, every month I would run the card manually myself. And then I got into a position like, this is just not going to work. So you have to start automating those billing charges. And then you need an invoice to apply that payment against. And so you need to automatically generate the invoice and automatically apply the credit card payment to this. So you start to look for all those little things that just make sense to automate. And it also comes down to staff training too. You know, I've realized that there's been times where I've automated something simply because my staff would get it wrong. You know, if it's something they do 100 times, they're not going to get it right 100% of the time for whatever reason. Maybe they're just having an off day. They might be sick. Maybe they forget, whatever it is. But I've realized that with automation, you can eliminate that human error, that human element, and get something to work 100% of the time the way it's supposed to work. So, you know, that's been kind of a super way to do it. And it's funny when my staff, I tell them, hey, I just automated that part. They're always like, oh my God, thank you. I hated doing that. So it's led to, you know, more efficient, more effective systems, and it has allowed us to scale. And the more I find that I automate, the easier it is for us to scale. So we're in a position now where we can add clients on without a whole lot of like additional work because we have those automations in place.
And like, so then what technology are you still using? Zapier, or using like what legal tech and what like legal tech adjacent or non-legal tech are you using? And that's okay. I mean, we talk about technology products all the time.
Sure.
They're getting some free promo. It's all good.
Yeah. So we still use Zapier. I've been using them for a long time. They, they recently changed their pricing structure, and I'm somehow still in a very, very cheap pricing structure compared to their new prices. So, you know, I'm considering looking at sources, but at the same time, you know, it's hard to value the, it's hard to put a dollar sign on the cost of switching. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hey, you can charge me a lot more, or I can pay someone a lot of money to switch to this other platform, and then they could do the same thing to me later on too. So, you know, that's a concern. Zapier is definitely a workhorse for us. We have started to do a lot of Google scripting. We're still on Google and look at Microsoft, but we do have some Google scripts that automate things really just in a position where they were kind of simple. They live just within the world of Google, so I don't have to worry about connections. And doing what we're doing in some of those scripts would be a very expensive task to do in Zapier. We use our work platform is something called Accelo, A-C-C-E-L-O. They call themselves Professional Services Automation Platform. I think I gave a talk about a year ago at MaxLawCon about finding the right software that's best for you. And so I was on one of the big practice management software platforms for a while. I think I gave a talk about Zapier at their conference once, and just got to a spot where, you know, a lot of the legal practice management software just doesn't get subscription. And so I started to realize that, hey, A, I'm using the wrong tool for the job. It just isn't built to handle this at all. And then also realizing that we needed a lot of data to start to figure this out. We need to start to figure out how much effort are we putting in? What are clients paying us? How do we attach that effort, the time that we're putting into these matters, to what they're paying us? And so we needed to get data out of the system. And a lot of times it was like, it felt like the legal practice management software was like, what do you mean you're not doing hourly? And they were just very confused. So I started to look for software that, rather than looking for lawyer specific software, I was like, you know what, I'm just going to eliminate that requirement. So, you know, I think at this point, the only legal specific software we use, you know, outside of like legal research and that sort of thing, I think it's LawPay. We still use them, still happy with them. But other than that, everything else we use is kind of just general business software that doesn't necessarily have the word legal in front of it.
Yeah, and I just wanted to quickly flag something for listeners in case you're on the cusp of launching a subscription model yourself. Don't get so focused on the data right away, because it's not going to be there until you've had the model running for a little bit. So I know, like, lawyers, a lot of times we want everything to be perfect and everything to be lined up before we launch. But like, so much of this is like building the ship as you sail it. And like, don't be focused on the data right away and collecting that data as you're building your practice, because so much will change from like year one to year two, speaking from personal experience now. But I, at a certain point, and I wonder what that point was for you, Andrew, like, when did that data all of a sudden become more valuable or necessary to see than later? Like, how many years into it?
It wasn't years. It was people, really.
Oh.
It was as I realized that I didn't want to be the only attorney. You know, it's one thing to say, hey, I'm a solo attorney and, you know, you're going to pay me X per month that I'm going to do everything for you. You know, I think that is at a spot where data wasn't as important. But once you get to a spot where you go from being the solo attorney to a manager, and probably a good 30 to 50% of my time right now is management, I needed the data to make management decisions. I needed to see how much time my team was spending on certain tasks. I needed to see, hey, they're spending a lot of time on that. Can we automate that? How do we reduce their time on that? Who's the best person to do that kind of job? So I think it was really, that is what happened. It wasn't necessarily the number of years. It was as to scale, you need data to get out of the, I'm a solo attorney doing this and I want to do this from a team perspective. I don't see how you could run a subscription based business, whether law firm or not, with multiple people without data.
Incredible insight. Really good stuff. If you were listening to this on 2x speed, go ahead and go back a few minutes and put it back to 1x speed. So something else I want to talk to you about, because so few of us do it, is you have your pricing available on your website. Now, I'm sure you might offer some other pricing or custom pricing or different things, but like, why the decision to, at least for the three prices you have on your website, why three and why those amounts?
Part of it is why not? You know, I would challenge that basic assumption that a lot of lawyers have, well, we don't put our pricing on our website. I mean, everyone else does. You know, a lot of people do. Maybe not in the service world, right? It's still, you can't go to a contractor's website necessarily and see that. That's something we've just kicked around for a long time. I think at one point in time, it obviously just started out is we needed a way to explain the subscriptions. We had to have our pricing somewhere. And, you know, when we do that, it can either be kind of in the back end or it can just be a website, right? I can either send you a PDF or I can send you a web page. And I think at the time it was like, well, just send them to a web page. If we're going to send them to a web page, we might as well just publish it.
When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney, or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form at scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
So that was, I think, part of it. And I think the other thing is just to kind of get clients in the right mindset, you know? Like I said, I was looking at your website, for instance, and I think your pricing starts at $20 a month, right? Our pricing starts at $7.50 a month. I don't want the people that are looking for a $20 a month service to call me. They cost me money, right? It costs me time to respond to that lead, get to that lead, that sort of thing. So I think it does get to the idea of finding that right client and the client persona and just getting the client in that mindset. And so I don't know, maybe we do turn away some people, but if we turn away some people, I'm okay with that. And I'm willing to kind of just get away from that offering. And it helps us get feedback too. You know, we ask clients about it, we show it to them. Sometimes like, yeah, I saw that. That's really interesting. So yeah, I think it really just boils down to why not.
Yeah. And something that I wonder though, that you bringing it up is because I do charge so little, but I have like three profiles, right? Of like potential clients. And some of them are like everyday people. Like, 'cause I'll be their fractional in-house counsel for their life. And it doesn't make sense for them to start paying me, you know, $2,500 a month, which is like my starting business level subscription.
Sure.
And then another one is solopreneurs or freelancers. And that's a totally different market than like the one that you're serving, right? And those are 300 and 1,000 depending on their needs. But a problem that I've run into charging such low prices is I'm getting reached out to by people across the United States. And I just can't like the way that I was on a podcast where we were talking about this with the GP Solo division of the ABA about like allowing for multi-jurisdictional practice explicitly. But how do you handle that? Like, because you're licensed where you're licensed, do you get licensed in other jurisdictions when those clients come in? Are you, since you're in like fractional in-house counsel, your perspective is, you know, you could kind of represent anybody anywhere because you're not going to court for them. Like, what has been your approach to multi-jurisdictional practice?
Yeah, we take a little bit more liberal approach to that. In the sense that it depends on what we're doing with the client, but also we look at it from the perspective of, you know, how much is this client worth to us, right? If it's we have a couple of multi-million-dollar companies that are out of state, and, you know, those clients that are paying us a few $1,000 a month, we're willing to look at the UPL laws in their particular state, understand those, and figure out how do we address those. Is it as simple as hiring enough counsel there? Is it, you know, we look at that. If somebody comes to us and says, hey, we had a business in Minnesota once that came to us and they wanted to do like our $750 a month package. And we simply told them, hey, it's not worth it for us to figure out the legal ethics of working with somebody in another state at this price point. We just turned that work away for now. You know, I recently was licensed in Texas. So, you know, now we have access to that state. And so that, you know, is part of kind of my strategy here is, hey, go get licensed in a state with a lot more people. And so, you know, one day it'd be nice to kind of take this, you know, idea national and see what happens. But at the same time, you know, there's challenges in going nationally because you make the pond a lot bigger. So there's some advantage in just having the pond to be, you know, as small as we are right now.
And for legal technologists listening that they don't know what UPL means, unlicensed practice of law is what UPL means.
Right.
And that begs yet another question that is a problem that I've been trying to solve with this podcast is how the heck do you handle referrals? Like, and especially amongst other subscription practices, because where if it's a flat fee or contingency type work, it's pretty industry standard, although not entirely standard for like a third is like the personal injury type referral fee. So like, how the heck are you thinking about like, if you have to refer it out because you can't scale fast enough or hire fast enough or grow and you got to refer that business out, like, or it's outside of your licensed jurisdiction, which happens to me all the time. Like, because I'm sending clients to people and I don't know, like I'm a subscription attorney too. So like, I don't know like what to expect or if people refer clients to me. Like, it's not clear, like, especially if they start mm-hmm. paying me $20 a month. Like, I'm sorry, I'm charging so little for that. I'm not sharing in that fee, right, to another attorney. So like, what have been your thoughts around like from subscription attorney to subscription attorney? Like, how do you handle those referral fees, whether it's coming into you or going out from you? What are you expecting?
Yeah, I mean, when it's coming into us, I can't, under Louisiana ethics, I cannot give anything of value for a referral. You know, so that's a pretty clear, I can't technically can't even buy you coffee. You know, I know in the personal injury world, there is, you know, a referral fee is a common thing. You know, I think that it is, you can pay the referring attorney to the commensurate with the value that they provided to a client, essentially is what it boils down to. But I, you know, we'll send thank you notes. We'll send Christmas gifts on a general basis to people, but we don't really, you know, give any sort of kickback for the fee. And I just haven't found a way around that.
Yeah.
And so it's not really something I'm willing to kind of play around with. When we need to refer a client, I look at it as helping the client find the legal services they need is one of the services we offer in our subscription, right? So if you have a legal problem that I can't solve, for instance, right now we have a client who they own a business here in New Orleans and we're helping them do some things. And they also own real estate in Michigan, but they have it in their personal name and they're wondering, hey, should we transfer this to an LLC? I'm like, you know, probably, but also I don't know the answer to that because I don't know Michigan law. And so, you know, our service here is, how do I connect them with a Michigan attorney, right? So it's vetting the attorney, it's finding the right attorney, it's connecting them with that, right? And I see value as that's part of our membership. So I'm not necessarily worried about getting that referral feedback. You know, I see it as more of, if I get the referral fee, great, that'll be some additional revenue for us. But my main motivation is I want to keep this client happy and keep them as a subscriber.
Right.
And so we're motivated by just making that introduction and keeping them around. And we haven't really run into the problem too much of someone I need to just completely refer out.
Yeah. And client retention, you know, reducing churn, really important in a subscription business. So what other things then are you doing in addition to just good customer service, finding them another lawyer if you can't help them? Like, what other things are you doing to reduce churn, keep clients happy, keep them subscribed?
Regular contact, making sure they have another appointment on the calendar, trying to find different things within the business that are low effort for us, but high value, reminding them that their insurance policies are about to expire, keeping track of contract termination dates, keeping track of their trademarks and brands, regularly touching base. So we have a system to, you know, try to track how often it's been since talked to somebody. But at the same time, you know, our clients at this point in time, you know, I think at one point in time, I had a $49 a month membership. I think that was the lowest I've ever gone. And we still have one client on that plan somehow. She's just kind of stayed on it for years. But at this point, you know, our new clients are spending a minimum of $750 a month with us. And I don't have to do a whole lot of work to keep them with us in the sense that, you know, these are business owners. To go back to that original idea, they want problem prevention, right? They've already kind of self-selected on that front. They want that, and there's nowhere else for them to go, at least right now. You know, there's not a whole lot of other options. So, you know, while we are implementing things and we do want to continue to add value, I'm not sitting here saying, haha, there's nowhere else for you to go, right? It's more of the sense that the people that have left us, you know, a lot of times it's they're closing their business, they sold their business. We have a very, very small percentage of our clients have gone to hourly rate attorneys away from the subscription. And a lot of times those were the clients who, you know, we would flag things and they weren't taking our advice or just weren't listening to us. And they weren't really our ideal client in that sense. So our clients that have left us, you know, or they're just, their business is in a rut and they need to save money somewhere. And they say, you know what, I can forgo legal expenses for a few months. I need to get my business on track here. So I think kind of all that is to say is that the clients that select into a subscription at a high level subscription, that there's not a whole lot of different things we really need to do to retain them other than, you know, offer the service that they paid for.
Because they're using it, especially when they're paying that much.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, so you need to make sure they use it. Right. And they do because they're paying that much.
Right. Which is not the gym membership model, which is charge the least amount so that they don't use it. And you keep getting that money without having to service the people, which I've some lawyers have, you know, mentioned the subscription model for legal services in that regard. And maybe that's ethical. I don't know. But it's a very different approach. And that's the and just because I'm charging $20 a month, that's not the right fit for every market. Mm-hmm. And when you're charging, I think the takeaway here is, yeah, when you're charging a premium, they're going to use it. And so churn reduction strategies are not as important because they're using it because they're paying.
Right, because you're. Yeah, I mean, when we had our lower price engagements, we had those were the engagements that had the highest churn, they had the lowest profitability, and we also track NPS pretty religiously. They had the lowest, they were giving us the lowest scores too. So those people had lowest profit, lowest customer value. I mean, it was just like across the board.
And for those who don't know, NPS, this is for the lawyers now, not for the legal technologists. NPS is Net Promoter Score.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question is like, how on a scale of 0 to 10, how likely are you to recommend the Sparrow Law Group to a friend or colleague? Mm-hmm. And those people were constantly upset at the fact that we weren't doing more for them at the price they were paying. So we, you know, eventually just got to the point of, you know what, this is what LegalZoom is for. There's other people in the marketplace offering this kind of service and we'll let them go there. And a lot of times people just had unrealistic expectations, even out as we tried to make them clear of what we could do for $50 a month.
Right. Now the one thing that I've learned from offering my model, I'm still very early in my journey, and maybe you experienced this and you decided, even with this, it's still not going to work for what we're building. But I have found like that business owners or even solopreneurs will subscribe at $20 a month, pay the $50 a page, and at a certain point, it stops making sense to pay $50 a page because that's the a la carte pricing I have available to my $20 a month subscribers. Mm-hmm. And that incentivizes them to start paying the higher monthly subscriptions that are just packaged in that I offer where I stop charging per page. So they test me out with like a commercial lease at $20 a month, $50 a page. All of a sudden, they've got more and more contracts coming in. And now they could be spending thousands of dollars a month, or they could start paying the bundled packages and they subscribe up. So like I've seen that movement happen. What do you think about that? Did you ever I don't know how your model was, how it used to be, but did you ever see any transitions mm-hmm. from lower subscribers into higher tiered levels?
Yeah, we've had that company a couple times, but it's been more the exception than the rule. Mm-hmm. For the most part, the people that were on the lower subscription models were frankly just a pain in the butt. You know, by and large, it was a problem, not really a solution for us. So, yeah, there's one of the clients I'm thinking about that's up leveled is kind of always consistently be a C or a B client. So it's never really been a great client. You know, we're really in a spot now where we're kind of focused and drilling in on the, hey, who are those A clients that, you know, kind of fit that client persona and don't need to be like babied into an upgrade. They get it, right? We have had clients kind of climb the ladder before, but you know, for the most part, it was also something we realized, hey, you know what, this might not be just the best fit for everybody too.
And in light of serving businesses, have you seen that once they're offloading their legal stuff to you? Because like you said earlier in the interview, how like the CEOs or the founders are usually the ones who are also in the legal seat because they don't have like a chief legal officer or in-house counsel. Like now that they've offloaded their legal to Sparrow Law Group, now they're increasing their profitability. Like, have you seen that happen with your clients?
Yeah, we've got a couple of clients where that's happened. I mean, we don't, you know, it's hard to track that as like a one-to-one correlation. It's more of a circumstantial correlation. But it is, hey, we're taking this off your plate. We're doing things for them that they didn't even know they could do for themselves, I think is really the advantage. It's not necessarily we're just, yeah, there's an advantage to freeing you up, but we're also freeing you up from, I find that when business owners are in the legal seat, they're only doing the things that are on fire. They only do the things that are incredibly obvious. They're not looking for the things that aren't obvious, that are the trap doors, the, you know, the things, the unforeseen issues. And so that is really, I think, where we bring value is, you know, you not only you're in the seat, but you don't know your blind spots in the seat. And so that really speaks to the clients, I think, is when they say, okay, not only do I, can I offload this legal work, but I'm buying a team that works with several dozen other businesses, and we're figuring out how do we take that logic and that experience and that knowledge earned from one client and applying it to the rest of the clients.
I can't not have an interview now where we don't talk about the new hotness, which is generative AI. So, Andrew, in what ways have you experimented with, or are you incorporating generative AI yet in your practice, or what ways are you thinking about potentially doing that?
Yeah, we're using it a lot for like first round of contract review. We're using, I think Rally has a product out there. It's Legal Sifter. There's a few different kind of contract review services out there. And, you know, we have a lot of these clients that will send us a 50-page contract I'd want to review. And we've found that AI, and our clients are open to this, is that we can give them a, you know, a redlined and marked up copy within 48 hours of a 50-page contract. And the only way we can do that right now is with AI, or by charging them, you know, the only way we can do that is by charging them a fee they're probably not willing to pay to staff that with an attorney who sits there and is just waiting for that. So, you know, I think that helps us meet the price point the clients are willing to pay, and also give them a product at a reasonable turnaround time. Whereas, you know, a traditional law firm would say, hey, here's 50 pages. I'll have this to you in 3 weeks. So that's one where we're using AI. We're also building the foundation for having all our client data able to be kind of tracked with AI. So, you know, a lot of client questions are either that they're looking for some sort of, you know, file, or they're looking for some sort of date. Hey, can you remind me what date my lease expires? It's a different question than, you know, prospective advice. So I see AI being advantageous to take an entire client's file and loading it into some sort of model and giving that client the answer to say, hey, based on that, this is your, you know, oh, hey, your lease expires on this date, and having the AI point to that file right away. And that could be useful to the client and internally. Mm-hmm. So we're working on that, and we're trying to figure out, hey, how do we take all these different meetings we have with clients, the meeting notes, the meeting recordings, the emails, their contracts, and then give the client kind of the ability to query their current legal standing. You know, how much is my premium on this insurance policy? What is my deductible? You know, a lot of these things that people need to kind of like figure out, where did I save that file and where do I go do it? I could see that AI being kind of useful in looking back at that. Whereas there's still a place for the lawyers to organize it and then give proactive advice. You know, the AI can't give that prospective foresight, right? It can only answer based upon what it's seen in the past. It can't look forward and talk about, well, if this happens, it's not quite to that. And I don't know if it'll ever get to that level, just based on the fact that it's entirely built off of the large language models. So yeah, we've got a few different ideas we're playing with. I mean, it's something that we're kind of slowly wading into. You know, it's expensive, it's time consuming to do. And at the end of the day, it's got to reflect value. And so, you know, that's kind of the other thing, is how do you balance the investment required to fully leverage it versus the cost versus the time versus, hey, will clients get value out of this? Right. You know, I don't think my clients necessarily want to, like, you know, they don't want to say, hey, I'm paying $1,000 a month. I don't want to get an email back from AI and a chat with a chatbot. You know, right now when I use chatbots, a lot of the services I use have launched chatbots as these like customer service agents. And I can say that probably like 9.5 out of 10 times they have been an absolute waste of my time. You know, I'm like, if I'm chatting with you, like I have gotten to the point where I'm chatting with you. And so kind of to that same point is, I want to make sure that AI is not, you know, if I'm going to use it with a client facing situation, it's not a, you know, it works 0.5% of the time, right? That needs to flip, where I can depend that it's going to give value to the client 9.5 out of 10 times, not 0.5 out of 10 times.
Right. I think I very well think it may get there, but yeah, I don't think it's there yet. a generative AI feature that I've seen, and this may actually help you, Andrew. We were talking about switching costs before because you're so connected with Zapier that it's going to be hard for you to switch. But I think Zapier and Make, and Make.com used to be Integromat, which is like a Zapier competitor. Mm-hmm. They both, I think Make was first to the scene, and then Zapier was like, shoot, we got to get on this. Whereas you just type in using natural language, like connect this to that, to this, to that, and you just type it in using English, and it will like make that integration for you. So instead of having to click and drag and drop and type in passwords and stuff, like both of these now, like this is on, I have not played with this yet. This is on my list of things to play with generative AI tools. But like that might make switching a heck of a lot easier than it would have been before, because now you just type in, connect this to that, do this with that, just like you would type in a Word document, and boom, like it like does it all for you. Supposedly, both of them are selling this feature now. But yeah, something to think about.
My experience with that is like, is AI is very good at very small snippets of code. But at this point, you know, I've been using Zapier for almost 10 years now, and our Zaps have continued to grow on top of each other. We have some exceptionally complex Zaps. And I just, when I've used the AI generative feature, it just does not work at all. Again, it gets into that realm of like, it works, you know, 0.5% of the time, but I do find it useful. Where if I say, hey, I have this block of text and I want a regular expression, I need a snippet of code to do this particular thing, I found it very useful in that. So I found AI to be useful in programming like a few lines of code. But when we talk about programming an entire program, an entire series, it just, to me, it's not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's... Yeah, I've played with those features on both of those fronts, and they're just not super useful.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. Maybe someday soon. So before I let you go, we're wrapping up here. Just like to actually power your subscriptions, like what is the tech you're using? Are you using LawPay for that? You mentioned LawPay earlier. Or is that through some other platform that you're like automatically charging these recurring payments to your clients?
Yeah, LawPay is just that we just use scheduled payments. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's fairly simple. It works, you know, we can put money in the trust and that works. And it's just, honestly, it's probably the one that I started using years ago. And when we started taking subscriptions, it was like, oh, they got a feature that does this. So we're kind of just, you know, there now.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's all we're using for our payments.
And then how does your jurisdiction handle? Cause I get this question all the time. Like, if they pay at the start of the month, do you have to put that in trust and transfer at the end? Is it an earned fee upon receipt? Like, how does your jurisdiction handle that kind of thing?
You know, Louisiana doesn't really address that. It's not super clear. They haven't really gotten into the weeds on that one. So I consider it an earned fee. And, you know, it's almost a situation in which, again, because I've gotten away from those low-end clients, you know, our clients are pretty sophisticated business owners, right? And they say a contract that says, we're going to do this and we do this. And so I'm almost inviting kind of the bar to look at it to say like, look, this is a multi-million dollar business owner that signed a contract. They knew what they were signing. We delivered on what they were signing. What's the problem? And challenging that idea of if the client is, you know, not, how is the client not protected by this? And so I would kind of invite that idea of like, hey, let's challenge Andrew's subscription model, because our clients know what they're getting into. You know, when there's an upcoming charge, I think someone gets 3 or 4 emails from us about the renewal, mm-hmm. you know? And so if somebody comes and says, hey, I paid Andrew all this money over the course of 3 years, it's like, well, here's the 500 emails I sent you. And we also charged your card. And so I kind of more or less rely on the idea that, you know, our systems and processes and our ideal clients, because they're sophisticated, where's the harm to the individual? You know, whereas if we were using kind of the gym member model, and I could see an attorney having a problem if, you know, the name on the credit card transaction wasn't the name of their firm. I could see them having trouble if they weren't sending any sort of, you know, there was no communication to the client whatsoever about the charge, and it was just a kind of obscure charge in the credit card every month. I could see that preventing a problem, but I struggle to see in what use case we get into a situation where somebody's complaining about it.
Yeah,
you know, it's just one of these things. That goes in front of the bar. It's an opportunity for me to, you know, if I was in a state that kind of makes me, you know, isn't an orange fee, I think I would almost invite that challenge to get in front of a bar and challenge that idea of this. Why are you getting in the middle of a relationship between two sophisticated business owners when everyone's happy?
Right. Illinois just adopted new rules on fees that I'll send you. It's very interesting on the subscription model.
Oh, cool.
So hopefully maybe if that happens, you'll have it for Louisiana. All right. So Andrew, thank you so much. My last question for you, a question I ask all my guests is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
No, because it's a hot dog.
Come on. Because it's a hot dog is not a good enough explanation. Give me a little bit more than that, Andrew. What's your reasoning behind because it's a hot dog?
It's a different thing. You know, a sandwich is, you know, it's more of two slices of bread between, I mean, it's a different category of thing. You know, it's like saying is, you know, like personal avatars, right? They're different things. You know, the $19 a month thing is not the same as the $2,500 a month thing.
Tying it back. I love it. You're the first one to tie back an earlier conversation.
I mean, are they both clients? Yes. But is the $19 a month client the $2,500 a month client? No.
Good. Nice analogy. I'll take it. If people want to follow up with you, what's the best way for them to do that or connect with you, find you, all that good stuff?
LinkedIn is probably the best place for me now. You know, we're experimenting a lot with sharing a lot of video on there, and we're just active there. That's probably the one social platform that I've started to check regularly. So, you know, just searching for me on LinkedIn, Andrew LeGrand, you'll find me easy enough there, and, you know, happy to connect with people and, you know, start using that platform.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thank you, Matthew.
Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for sponsoring this show. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with someone you think would find a value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kerbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kerbis with Law Subscribed.